Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 27th of September 2016, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we are going to be joined by
David Ellis.
David Ellis. Thank you, Mike. Small pause there. Sorry, David. David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. And I'll just say the weather's overcast. And a little bit grey, a little bit chilly, a little bit rainy in some places. But we've got more important things to talk about because we've got some extraordinary information starting to come together about what is going on in UK and also overseas. And what is the network between it all? Well, it comes down to money.
Yeah, so let's start off with Merrill Lynch. Now, $12.5 million is a pretty small fine as in the greater scheme of things. Some of the fines that we've seen will be coming on to Deutsche Bank in a second are significantly larger than that. But there are a couple of interesting aspects to this story because they have been fined $12.5 million by the SEC in the United States for what are described as mini flash crashes. So they've agreed to pay this amount to settle these allegations. They have not admitted any wrongdoing, but they're saying that, or the SEC is saying that Merrill Lynch failed to stop 15 large trades that they say caused Google, Diageo, and other stocks to crash between 2012 and 2014. And one example that they gave was a Merrill trader who entered an order to sell 381,020 shares using an algorithm which was intended for a different order. And of course, what's being highlighted here is algorithmic trading and how traders are putting orders into the markets, which are then handed over to a computer algorithm, in many cases trading very fast. And so human beings don't have time or the ability to see exactly what's going on. So that order that the SEC gave as an example was 483% of the normal average daily trading volumes, which of course moved the markets. Merrill Lynch saying that nobody lost any money as a result of that. But the interesting aspect of this is that the SEC has for a number of years had stops in place to make sure that if this type of activity goes on, that if trading starts going out of certain bounds, that trading gets rolled back and stopped. That's kind of a plunge protection situation going on there, automated, of course. Well, people have been writing about the dangers of this kind of fast paced algorithmic trading. I mean, it's getting to the point that these high volume trading operations are moving physical infrastructure closer to the exchange just to shave a few milliseconds off the trading time so they can try to get in before other people do. It's dangerous, and Merrill Lynch been fined for it in this case.
Can I just comment on that, Mike? Interesting, we've got trading by machines, and you've reported on the rise of computers generating news stories. So we're living in the bizarre world of the machine trade, and who reports on it? Another machine.
Absolutely. But, even the machines can't avoid reporting Deutsche Bank at the moment. So here we go. Deutsche Bank shares taking a fresh hit, according to the Financial Times. 7% loss yesterday, another 3% or so down today. They had bounced, dead cat bounce, I think, from their 1983 lows today, and that was being described as the Clinton effect. After what everybody was assuming was her win in the debate last night. But of course, it didn't take long for people to wise up and they started to come back down again. So what we've got is a bank which is absolutely crashing and the German government saying that they will not bail it out. An awareness in the markets that Deutsche Bank is screwed, shall we say.
Interesting, isn't it? And of course, another bank, Lehman was one, but another bank thoroughly recommended as a role model for leaders in society by political charity Common Purpose. School children invited to take part in events with Deutsche Bank on the basis that these bankers are the people we should be following to lead us over the rainbow into the new world. And now we've got another one bankrupt. I don't suppose we'll be hearing from Julia Middleton, the chief executive of Common Purpose, on the loss of another German bank.
No. Theo, I think we've lost David. If we could see if we can get it back. But in the meantime, let's have a look at this. Now, this is a couple of weeks old, this story. This is Royal Bank of Scotland and the fact that companies that were asset stripped by Royal Bank of Scotland are attempting to go after the regulator, which is the Financial Conduct Authority. Now, the article here in the Times saying hundreds of businesses are threatening the city regulator with legal action because of delays to a long-awaited report into the activities of the Royal Bank of Scotland's restructuring unit. Lawyers acting for more than 400 companies which claim they were mistreated by RBS's global restructuring group have written to the Financial Conduct Authority saying that they plan to launch a judicial review into the handling of this issue. Now, as I say, this article was reported a couple of weeks ago. Why am I bringing this up just at the moment? Well, tomorrow in this news slot, because Brian and I will be in Scotland, I'm going to be playing out a never-before-seen interview with a gentleman called Colm Canning, who's an ex-Ulster Bank senior manager. Ulster Bank, of course, part of RBS, and he left Ulster Bank because he was not willing to take part in the asset stripping that was going on around GRG, the Global Restructuring Group. He was involved in the writing of the Tomlinson report, that then led to the FCA running this investigation, which has completely failed in the last 2 years to say anything further about what was going on with RBS. Hopefully that means that we're going to see, with this pressure building, some movement on this. But in the meantime, we're going to add our pressure by playing out the interview that we did a few weeks ago with Colm.
And an excellent interview it is. Another extraordinary story of sheer corruption in the banking industry. And the effect, of course, it has on businesses, which is one of the key points that he makes.
Yes. Now, I was trawling the government websites as I do of a morning, and came across this little story: UK government's anti-corruption support to Sierra Leone. And at first glance, it doesn't seem like much of a story, but let's just go through it and explain why I was interested in it at the end of the day. It says UK government's anti-corruption support to Sierra Leone, Pay No Bribe, is an innovative reporting platform where citizens can anonymously report incidents of petty corruption and bribery. Citizens can register an incident by calling a hotline phone number, they can also report on the website, or they can use a mobile application. And the recorded data will allow the government of Sierra Leone to monitor public sector corruption trends and use quantitative evidence to design more effective anti-corruption policies and processes. So, you might say that Sierra Leone is potential corruption problem there. This is a step in the right direction, perhaps. But why was I particularly interested in it? Well, it was because of this. Counting the Pennies, a report just out today by Transparency International UK. And what are they saying? They're saying that secrecy behind the UK's public spending is protecting, or could be protecting, corruption in the UK.
I shouldn't think there's any corruption at all in UK, Mike.
No,
really.
Indeed. So report states that, gives an example of the borough of Hackney, £14 million invested in projects, but documents so heavily redacted that it wasn't possible to tell who was receiving or the cash, who was spending the money. They found that procedures were opaque. They found that when data was available and accessible through Freedom of Information, for example, that the data was presented in such a complex way that they said it defied analysis. And they highlighted that 81,057 different column names used by public authorities to describe the money they've spent. So it's impossible to know, impossible to actually follow this money through. They say that they analysed £2.3 trillion of publicly available transactions made by national and local government between 2011 and 2015. And they concluded that the UK has, in theory, one of the most open governments in the world, but the system is not working properly in practice. Well, I'm going to say the government has no such thing. The 81,057 column names. This is not accidental. This is deliberate obfuscation. It allows the government to say, oh, we're being transparent. But in fact, what they're doing is swamping us with so much data that it's impossible to actually follow the money, as it were. Brian, I think Transparency International, if they'd been paying any attention to us, for example, the presentation you gave on corruption in Cornwall, I think it was called In Cornwall Unconcerned, describes exactly this type of corruption and money disappearing to pay for things like weddings.
And recording studios that didn't exist. Cornwall is a classic example of the EU taking control by injecting money, which was then not accounted for. And what did that do? Well, the person controlling the purse string controls the policy. That's the first thing it did. And then by allowing the corruption to flourish, as took place in Sheffield, as one particular case, millions of pounds disappeared in that city, but Cornwall was the same. People caught up in the corruption were then owned. They could be controlled or blackmailed. And 320 million was the start of the money going into Cornwall. Similar big sums of money going into Plymouth on a regular basis, and with it followed a trail of corruption.
You know, I haven't, despite living in Plymouth, I haven't spent too much time in Cornwall, but any time I'm there, I'm just amazed at how run down it is in many places, despite all these hundreds of millions of pounds of European and other money going in. So you just ask the question, where has it all gone?
It was all frittered away on little projects that were never going to do anything to help revitalise Cornwall. But let's remember, of course, it was the EU that smashed Cornwall apart by destroying fishing and farming, the two key industries, which traditional industries of Cornwall. Well, if we mention open government, then, of course, we need to talk about the Freedom of Information Act. And the man who regretted bringing that act in is none other than Tony Blair. But what's he been saying? Well, he's decided that the suffering of British troops is a good idea, is a good opportunity for him to make hay for himself. So he's been commenting on the intended trial of British soldiers for so-called failings, atrocities in Iraq and other places. He had this to say: I do not think this process should ever have been put in place. I am very sorry that our soldiers and their families have been put through this ordeal. He says our armed forces gave extraordinary service in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, this type of investigation simply makes their job harder to do. Sorry, there's a typo there. I don't think this process should ever have been put in place. Well, what can we say? We just remember that this gentleman here is the man who created it. So we thought probably what he was thinking was that my real cynical agenda here is to stick up for the troops so that people forget I am the man who created the unlawful war, death and destruction in Iraq, and thus ultimately created this mess for the troops in the first place. I did actually produce this particular graphic yesterday, and I was interested to see that the Daily Mail seemed to have already picked up on this and said the sheer hypocrisy of this man is vile. I don't think there's any other word for it. But yes, Tony Blair was the man who said he deeply regretted bringing in the Freedom of Information Act, because, of course, it allowed an educated public to start to see the fraud and corruption that was endemic in his government. Well, let's have a look at our politicians at the moment. And let's go back to an article in our local Plymouth Herald. Plymouth pie-faced poets and politicians share their New Year's resolutions. So this is back to January 2016. And we better bring in the priority of our local MPs, because here he is, Mr. Hedgehog, Oliver Colville. He started the year saying his priority was hedgehogs, and he's certainly still on hedgehogs. So I don't think we should be surprised if we see nothing is working in the country at the moment. But presumably the little hedgehogs are doing OK. Well, we're bringing another man. This is Gary Streeter, and I'm going to thank the gentleman who sent me this article from a local paper. A word from your MP is only certainty left, death and taxes. Well, this is Mr. Streeter. He also featured in this article. He's a very big Christian, apparently, looking very sweet in this picture. And this is in the garden of his local mansion in Plymouth. So no small semis for Mr. Streeter. He's certainly extremely well endowed in the dwelling region. So if we have a look at the article, it's quite remarkable because he said he's got constituency, people in the constituency coming to him talking about all sorts of nutty ideas, and he considered them to be untrue. For instance, that there's a secret Tory plan to privatise the NHS. Well, all the information that we're getting at the moment is that the NHS is virtually privatised. So either this man is blind or incompetent, or something else is going on. Well, happily, Mr. Streeter explains for us what's going on. So let's have a look at the rest of the article. Each of us must decide for ourselves our own version of truth. So Mr. Streeter doesn't think, as a Christian, there's any truth. We just simply look out of the window and decide what version we think is correct, and then we can run our lives. Well, if that's what Mr. Streeter thinks, it's clearly what David Cameron thought, or Tony Blair, or Gordon Brown. So we are back on the fact that we've got some extremely dangerous men and women running the country, and we shouldn't be surprised if there is no truth left at all. Phenomenal eyes he's got in that picture, Mike, do you think? Well, let's remember that Gary Streeter is the very MP that defended this man. And Brooks Newmark has been back in the mainstream press because he's trying to get all of the pictures showing him, I think the word is in the nuddy, removed. And the Daily Mail had picked up on the fact that whilst Brooks Newmark was busy flaunting his beer belly over the mainstream press, his daughter is showing rather more. And the point was hypocrisy in the family. But let's remember that the very same Brooks Newmark thought that he was the man who should sit in a suit judging President Assad. And of course, what did he want? He was calling for the arming of terrorists to achieve regime change in Syria. So there you have it. You have local Tory MP Gary Streeter, who doesn't believe the truth exists, and he's happy to stick up for a man who has, well, made a fool of himself, made a fool of the British nation, and is the man who was very keen to arm terrorists. And as we'll be seeing later in the news, those terrorists are now, of course, utterly destroying civilian targets in Syria. Well, we'll just bring in a quick ad. Tonight in Glastonbury, there is Assert the Rule of Law. This is part of the initiative by the British Constitution Group to get people thinking about what is actually happening in the UK. We have lost the rule of law, and we need to start steps to regain it. And a reminder as well, November the 19th, the British Constitution Group's got a full meeting in Winchester on the same subject, reasserting the rule of law. Tickets are now available through the website at £10 each. That is a reduction for tickets sold in advance. It will be £20 on the door if you turn up on the day. Very important event, and some really excellent speakers, including the banker, Colm Canning, that Mike has just mentioned. We're in very, very serious times, Mike, as we're about to hear with European security.
Indeed. Michael Fallon here. Sir Michael Fallon. Indeed, sir. No less. Sir Michael Fallon, he is over in Bratislava. Now, of course, we just had an EU meeting over in Bratislava. We were having another one yesterday and today, and this is an informal defence minister's meeting. So this is him meeting his German counterpart, Ursula von der Leyen. Well, what are they talking about? Well, what he's saying across many of the British mainstream papers today is that the UK is going to oppose any attempt to create an EU army, because he says that that would, quote, undermine the role of NATO. Okay, so that's a key point. Fallon saying that he's going to oppose an EU army because that is going to undermine NATO. He's saying that NATO must remain the cornerstone of our defence and the defence of Europe. He's saying we're not going to continue to oppose the... We are going to continue to oppose any idea of an EU army or an EU army headquarters, which would simply undermine NATO. So that's actually a very clever form of words there. What he said is, but we are going to continue to oppose any idea of an EU army or an EU army headquarters, which would simply undermine NATO. So it's heavily qualified, this opposition to the EU army. So what's this meeting about? Well, it comes following the Three Stooges here. That's Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO in the middle. Donald Tusk on the left, one of the EU presidents, and Juncker on the right, the other EU president. And they issued a joint EU-NATO declaration following the Warsaw summit in June this year. Said that they were going to have substantial cooperation between NATO and the EU. They considered them to be unique and essential partners, that this partnership was established more than 15 years ago, and that this partnership contributes to the Euro-Atlantic security, that they intended to develop coherent, complementary and interoperable defence capabilities of EU member states and NATO allies, as well as multilateral projects. They're going to facilitate a stronger defence industry and greater defence research and industrial cooperation within Europe and across the Atlantic. Cooperation in these areas is a strategic priority, is what they were saying at the time. So this morning, there was some more discussions on this. And, Federica Mogherini, who is effectively the European foreign minister, met Jens Stoltenberg, and they had a very close embrace as they got out of the cars.
At least they've got their clothes on, Mike. That's all I could say.
The way they were going, I don't think it was going to be that way for too long. I'm not quite sure what happened once they went in the building, but that's they then went in front of television cameras and gave a bit of an opening statement. The message from the EU and from NATO is that stronger EU defence makes NATO stronger. So let's remember what Fallon said. We are going to continue to oppose any idea of an EU army or an EU army headquarters, which would simply undermine NATO. But it's absolutely clear from what Mogherini and Stoltenberg are saying that that is not going to be the case. Have you got any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's very straightforward. There's this informal nonsense. It's not informal. This is where they're obviously going to thrash the thing out properly. So you've got NATO going into atrophy. The EU military union is forging ahead at great speed. And they've already told everyone there what the sort of game is. We want to get control of all the money flows, policy flows, industrial procurement and the capital budgets. So for Fallon to say that he's opposing this is complete nonsense, because he's just, you know, he's really, really been caught out. The balloon's gone up and he's realised he's in dangerous water, because for quite some time under Cameron, either during the coalition or not on this recent parliament, his sole work has been about intertwining us. And that's what's been going on. That's the whole purpose of all the reviews, the cuts and the interoperability and everything he's talked of. So to say that he's vetoing is a complete nonsense. We've already got that from John Redwood last week, that confirmation there. There's a huge amount of intertwining between our armed forces. So to then say that he will then oppose it is just nonsense. He's not going to be able to stop it. He's absolutely, none of his ducks are lined up properly. You know, this is almost like he's giving everyone a self-fulfilling press announcement here of his own demise and condemnation. So to then go on to say about the formation, it's forming up in front of us, that's blatant, and to say about the HQs, well, this is complete tosh, because I already know for a fact via three senior officers from the Royal Navy that the HQs are already built. So this is just complete and utter, you know, some sort of Paul Daniels magic trick. You know, this isn't, you know, they're trying to delude the public. Those HQs are already built. They're just ready to be switched on once they get political agreement. So Fallon's in real hot water with this, and so is the government, because they're going to feel the political whiplash from the public once the truth comes out. And, you know, all these Cruyff turns or whatever they think they're doing with these statements that keep making, these political Cruyff turns, you know, they're just not going to wash.
Right, David, just to get some more comment from you on this, I just wanted to highlight a couple of quotes here from after their meeting. because they had a sort of press gathering. And Stoltenberg said, there's no contradiction between strong European defence and strong NATO. Actually, it reinforces each other. The importance is that we avoid duplication, that it is complementary. And then Mogherini went on to say that they had found common ground on the need to strengthen European defence cooperation and in full complementarity with NATO. And she said that following the agreement that we've just talked about in Warsaw in July, she said that with no duplications, with mutually reinforcing our work. So this looks like they're taking this model that they've had across Europe with the strategic defence reviews and making sure that there's no overlap in capability. And it looks like what they've agreed is to draw that out NATO-wide and not just Europe-wide.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, this no overlapping is the language of basically what will happen is the EU military union, a.k.a. EU army, will go to the fore. That's what it means. You know, it won't overlap because the EU will be in charge. They'll be in charge of the money and they'll be in charge of policy and they'll be in charge of everything all the way down to the troops at the front in their royal blue outfits with their golden stars. That's the reality. They have to, you know, in order to support the euro that's failed. This has to happen. And all of our politicians are completely behind the curve on it. You know, it's not as if we haven't sent enough warnings out over the last 2 or 3 years on this. And none of them are listening. They're all busily standing, watching the EU amass Parliament's own funeral pyre.
So do you think they are actually behind the curve, or is this just some public front that they're putting up?
There's probably a bit of both, and I'm definitely with Rod Atkinson on this, that these other factions are making hay here because there's so much ineptitude in Parliament. So there'll be a tiny few that are complicit, but the majority of them will just be completely inept.
Okay, well, I'd just like to highlight an article that you've written up on the UK Column website at the moment. EU military union is budgetary union. Just give us a brief overview.
There's a very simple recipe here. The draftsmen in the middle of World War II and at the end of World War II at the Bank of International Settlements that wanted to stabilise economic growth and economic stability in the Eurozone wanted unification, and they've wanted it for perhaps for a century. And out of that, the master plan was currency union. Okay, tick, done that. We've got the euro. The second key component was military union. And we've been fudging around that now for 60 or 70 years because nobody wants to come clean with it. It's a political hot potato. It's very difficult to get. They were not stupid. They knew it was going to be incredibly difficult to get the general public to swallow it, considering two world wars, what that would actually mean. So you've got this democratic variance between the people and the banks and the powers that be. So the reason they want the military union is because it instantly gives rise to the treasury and the powers then of a treasury in the EU zone. So that's tax. So in effect, what we'll do is we will surrender Her Majesty's Armed Forces and all that goes with them. And we will then pay again. This is a double whammy. So at that point, we no longer become a state because we don't have power, or neither does anybody in Europe. They don't have control of their own military. It then becomes a state, and it's a state of tyranny. It's a dictatorship because it's run by an elected commission. So those are the component forms. And all of the mechanics and inner workings thereof, we sort of go through within the article as to why that's important to get control of the money. It's the money that's the key, and they want to prop up the euro because it's you know, failed quite clearly.
Okay, David, thank you very much for that. Well, we know that British military equipment has been absolutely decimated by successive governments. And David Cameron doing that dirty deal of the 50-year pact with the French. He's then got rid of our aircraft carriers. He's got rid of the maritime patrol aircraft and the Royal Navy at the moment, in particular, in a pitiful state. What we're also seeing is a massive attack on the men and women in the services. Now, how's this being done? Well, this is part of it. So we'll bring in the Telegraph here, which is back on this subject about British troops facing mass criminal investigations over Taliban claims. And they have set up a whole operation for this. The mod-established Operation Northmoor, headquartered at RAF St Morgan near Newquay in February this year, And it's reported that some staff from the National Crime Agency, Britain's equivalent to the FBI, have also been seconded to the project. So this is Operation Northmoor. It includes the private company Red Snapper that was providing, of course, legal teams. But let's think this through. If people know that if they dare to volunteer for the armed forces, they're put into a combat zone overseas, they do something wrong, or indeed they do nothing wrong, but somebody accuses them of wrongdoing, the next thing is they're up on criminal charges. And like Sergeant Alexander Blackman, they can then end up in prison for years. So by making a public trial of troops, what we're actually doing at this stage is undermining confidence in the British armed forces. So people are not going to join. And so the already poor recruiting is going to drop further. David, it is fascinating. I want to say a bit more about it, that this operation should have been put into being in RAF St Morgan, the very base which we identified together with your good self on UK column before any other national media outlet had got near it.
Absolutely. All credit to UKC, Brian, Mike, everybody there at the team. And I need to probably give a few people my end a bit of credit here, all the servicemen, all the officers, junior officers and senior officers, that have assisted us with this over the last few years. We wouldn't have got to where we are now with the unravelling of this and the revelations and the point of revelation that we're at now. With regard to this pincer move that we're seeing, this is the absolute wanton planned destruction of Her Majesty's Armed Services. So we're selling off the major assets at one end well short. And this is deliberate. This is by design, by their own admissions. And at the other end, we are going to criminalise and lock up our own service personnel. So what we're doing, we're destroying the brand, what they're doing. They're destroying the brand of Her Majesty's Armed Services. So they will discredit, prevent any recruitment. Who the hell in their right mind is going to want to join this? No one. And that's by design, because the new brand has got to come in. And the new brand is EU military, not Her Majesty's, you know. We are now at the point of no return. Unless there is a standing to, there will not be a British Armed Services. It's as simple as that.
David, I couldn't agree more. And of course, we also have to add for that, why do we need our armed forces? Well, it's obviously not just to protect us from overseas external threats to the UK. It's also to defend ourselves should we end up with a criminal government, which is hell-bent on tyranny. But let's remind ourselves the evidence has been there for what's happening for some time. This is an Express article some weeks ago. EU army will happen and it will weaken British defences, warns a retired colonel. And this is the gentleman, Colonel Kemp. He was prepared to stand up and say what was coming. Where are we now? Well, we've got treason and lies from our own government, because as you've already said, the EU military dictatorship is formed and can be activated inside 24 hours. We now know that is capable of subsuming the British Armed Forces, and the integration continues despite Brexit. So if we just remind our viewers, this was the original article we had on the 27th of April 2016. And we basically announced the fact that the EU military headquarters had been set up in RAF St Morgan. And we also said that David Cameron was deceiving the public, because there'd been no public debate on this or public announcement. And this is a dangerous situation, because if our own government was to create violence on the streets, then you could bring in the military onto the streets, except it wouldn't be British military. What would be happening would be your EU forces coming in. And at the time we made this report in April, of course, what was happening was massive joint exercises with the French, British Army and the French Army exercising. And the French already had their command and control troops in Newquay. Now we know that same base is going to be used as the centre to try British troops who've put their lives on the line overseas. Outrageous is the best I can do on this one, but the evidence is all in front of us at the moment. How do we get this information out to the wider public, do you think, David? Do we need to do more? Do we need to get in amongst the veterans associations in order to get this information through to them?
Yes, absolutely. Everyone, regardless of your, you know, what you're doing is in terms of your job or your, you know, your background, everyone has got to get behind this. You've got to pressure to literally in a face-to-face fashion with your MP. You've got to disseminate this information to anybody that you know within your area that's service or ex-service, because the time is drawing near. And I just can't stress enough how important this is, that everybody gets this out into the open and talks about it. It is vital.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Rodney Atkinson, so we'll bring him up on the screen, because on his site, a really excellent article hitting exactly the same spot, that we're talking Brexit, but actually, as far as the military is concerned, the opposite applies. The military is being locked ever deeper into the procurement system with the European Union, the sharing of weapons systems, and ultimately joint operations. So very dangerous stuff. Meanwhile, of course, the government is busy ramping up the threat, or apparent threat, from Russia. Russia today picking up on it. And here we've got one of the headlines. NATO is reviewing nuclear playbook to deter terrible attacks by Russia. This is according to the Pentagon chief. It's a very good article. Encourage people to go and read it. But America ramping up the rhetoric in order to cover the aggressive action that's been carried out, particularly by the US and the UK in Eastern Europe. But if you have a look at what the US Department of Defense is tweeting out, they're really going for it. America's nuclear deterrence is the bedrock of our security and the highest priority mission. They're also saying that we need to invest in deterrence, but we've also got to keep investing in our people. So the Americans here are ramming and ramming it home that it's that nasty Russia that's causing the problem. And presumably the Americans don't want to talk about what's happening in Syria. Well, we better just bring in the latest and greatest F-35, because yet another one has caught fire. So let's remember that this is the type of aircraft that's eventually going to come into the, or one of the variants is going to come into the UK armed forces. So we've got crumbling airframe. We've got engine fires now coming in with this aircraft. It seems to me that this particular aircraft is less than what do we say? A1.
So this it had this engine fire because it got a breath of wind up its backside, Brian. And you've got to ask on an aircraft carrier. This is supposed to be
You do get a bit of wind at sea, apparently.
This is supposed to be able to operate in dodgy conditions. Well, clearly it can't.
Well, presumably we'll just restrict the carriers to operate in cold water and calm days. So we're making light of it, but this is serious stuff. Who is manipulating behind the scenes? Well, let's bring in Prince Charles, because we had an excellent article sent to us here, Strategic Culture. Prince Charles is to strengthen ties with Gulf dictators. November will be visits by Charles and Camilla, which will help strengthen the UK's warm bilateral relations with key partners Bahrain, Oman and United Arab Emirates. And what are we going to? We just come on to this one here. You'll see where this leads in a minute. But we've got the NHS. Well, what's the connection? Well, basically, the NHS has appointed a new director of leadership development, and they're going to be leading within the NHS Leadership Academy. So we're switching from defence to NHS. Stay with me. Let's have a look at the man. We've got Stephen. He's joining after a long career in the Royal Marines, where he worked as a leadership practitioner in operational roles around the world as part of a strategy team in the Ministry of Defence, most recently working to drive change and improvement in the command leadership and management behaviours of the Army and Royal Navy. Some interesting language there, David. This man who's been changing military behaviour is now going to be helping out in the NHS. And what is the NHS up to? Well, we're all delighted to learn that they've set up a memorandum of understanding that they're going to be working with Saudi Arabia, well known for its excellent medical and humanitarian skills. So we've got a mixture of very dubious military-trained leadership people now working within the NHS, which is itself developing memorandums of understanding to sell our NHS medical expertise, Staffordshire Hospital presumably, through to Saudi Arabia. This is almost humorous, David, but it's not. There is something deeply sinister going on here, that people who are involved in leadership, and by this we're talking reframing, behavioural change, are mixing military roles with what's happening in the NHS, with memorandums of understanding of very, very, Saudi, I'm going to say dangerous overseas states. What do you make of this?
Yeah, as soon as you see this change management and this kind of language, it's alarm bells, alert code 5, isn't it? You know, this is absolutely what we don't want. This is completely the other thing. And you know, on a military sense, you know, the reason they keep talking about change and using all this perverse language is because they need to get rid of Her Majesty's Armed Services and all that goes with it, because we need to change to EU military union, EU Army, EU Navy, EU Air Force. And I don't doubt, looking at this, that there is exactly the same workings going on with the NHS. It'd be exactly the same model and workings.
Yeah. Well, we'll follow his trip through. Let's bring Prince Charles back on screen, if we may. And we've got here that the Saudi foreign minister has already hinted that Britain could have a free trade agreement. This is for you, Mike. Mm-hmm. I thought you'd be interested in this, with the six GCC countries, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So what's Charles up to? Well, he's smoothing the path for weapons sales, of course. But what the press are not talking about in UK is what albab.com is talking about, which is that there's been great criticism of UK arms sales to Saudi within Parliament. Parliamentary committee says it was not happy, and that has unleashed some dirty deals. They said the weight of evidence of violations of the international humanitarian law by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen is now so great that it's very difficult to continue to support Saudi Arabia while maintaining the credibility of our arms licensing regime. But just the sorts of people you want to link together with the NHS, of course, Mike. Mm-hmm. So this man popped up, Crispin Blunt, MP. He basically walked out of a meeting so that that committee virtually collapsed. And when he was challenged about this on the BBC, very rare that I give the BBC any credit, but I am in this occasion because they pressed him as to what happened, but he didn't want to say. But this Tory is desperate to help preserve the arms deals with the Saudis. When I went researching him, I quickly came to David Halpin's website, where there is an interesting letter where David Halpin has challenged this gentleman himself on what he believes in, particularly in relation to the Middle East. And I would encourage our viewers today to go to David Halpin's website to read what he says himself.
The title there is The Voyage to Gaza, if you want to search for it.
Yeah, The Voyage to Gaza. Thank you. So this is extraordinary stuff, Mike. We've got the Yemen being smashed to pieces. We've got people pointing a finger at Saudi and other Middle Eastern countries on their appalling human rights records. But we're selling the arms and we're teaming up through the NHS.
Absolutely. Now, of course, the rhetoric from the United States with regard to Assad and Russia's cooperation in Syria is reaching fever pitch. And if there's any truth in this headline from Sputnik, it's going to be a bit difficult for them, because Sputnik here reporting that the Damascus government has an audio recording of ISIS radio transmissions with the US military before the US military bombed the Syrian army last Monday. So this article hadn't heard these audio clips yet. They're to be released later today if they haven't been while we've been on air. So I'm looking forward to hearing those. And if it's true, it's going to be pretty embarrassing for the United States.
Yeah. Well, David, we'll bring you back in just a second, but let's follow through on this because another article from Russia Today, which I encourage people to go and read, is basically giving publicity to an interview that was done by a German journalist with one of the al-Nusra commanders, Abu al-Ez. And in the interview, this is some of the things that the al-Nusra commander says. Yes, the US supports the opposition in Syria, but not directly. They support the countries that support us. But we're not yet satisfied with this support. We need more sophisticated weapons. And this one is quite telling. Jabhat al-Nusra won battles thanks to TOW anti-tank rockets. Now, this is relatively old technology, but in terms of what may be available in the Middle East, it would be leading edge. Due to these rockets, we reached a balance with the regime. Our tanks came from Libya via Turkey, joined by the multiple rocket launchers. So there's the clue. David Cameron, of course, smashed Libya apart. Where did the weapons go? Well, here we can see they've gone straight into the hands of al-Nusra. And he goes on to say this: when Jabhat al-Nusra was besieged, we had officers from Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Israel and America here, experts in the use of satellites, rockets, reconnaissance and thermal security cameras. So the message is very clear that basically it's the assistance, particularly of the United States, but also the Saudis and Israel, that are funding the terrorists and equipping the terrorists in order to overturn the Assad regime. David, if the glove was on the other hand or the boot was on the other foot, we would be screaming about this. But we've got the West funding and equipping terrorists and describing them, as we said yesterday, as rebels. It's outrageous.
It is outrageous because the proliferation is only geared for one thing. And we've got a three-quarter global currency war going on. And that's ultimately what's at the base of this, or at the top of this, whichever way you look at it. So the whole problem here is that they need to shore up the currency, the dollar. So that's why it's intertwined with Saudi and the oil, you know, oil, dollar, oil. That's that relationship tick. And the problem we've got here in Europe is that that's obviously intertwined with the dollar, and they need their military union in order to prop up the euro. So this is why we've got this catalyzing exacerbation out here in Syria. They've used Syria as the soft touch, can get away with that. So they're fanning the flames out there and hoping that they can, as a result of it, give birth to their military union. Now, they might need to go a bit further because it's not actually working at the minute. It's stalling. We've had Brexit. There's a lot of ex-senior officers voicing concerns about what this will actually mean for our country and all the other countries. So the whole problem will be is they can't get their own way at the minute. We haven't quite given birth to the European military construct. What do we need to do? Well, we need a bit more trouble. So just a little engagement with Russia, not a too big one, but a little engagement. And that would be enough of an argument with all the propaganda machines that they've already got out there to give birth to it. So we're pretty much actually, as far as peoples in the West, now relying upon Mr. Putin's discretion. Because, you know, he could go the other way with this. He could go, well, you're not having a little war. I'm going to give you a bloody nose because I'm fed up. You know, we could be back to almost the Cuban Missile Crisis here where, you know, are we going to start using nuclear depth bombs at sea again on Russian squadrons if things start getting a bit twitchy? Is that the level of proliferation we're going to get to? So it's very, very worrying times. I think with the stuff that's coming out now, we're looking at almost as if the West is on DEFCON 2.
Thank you. I pause because this is exactly how serious the situation is. David, thank you for all of that excellent analysis. And I'm just going to end by saying, if our wider audience is still not sure what the problem is in UK, let's just have a look at key figures in the Labour conference. And here we are. Who did the media focus on? Eddie Izzard. And he was crying, tears welling up, apparently, over the death of Joe Cox. I don't see any tears welling up for the thousands and thousands, the hundreds of thousands of children who've died in the Middle East as a result of Western political agenda. But men in pink berries and lipstick helping to run the country. I think I can understand what's going wrong. That's it for today. David, once again, thank you very much for joining us. We will be away for 2 days. So for tomorrow and Thursday, we'll normal services resumed on Friday. And as Mike has said, we'll be showing
other material.
Thank you. Yeah. For tomorrow and Thursday. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll see you Friday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.